She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
Welcome, workers, to your 20th year, employed by Nerd and Tie Industries, where you shall remain until you are of no use to Trade Dawn. This is a good thing. Your life before Nerd and Tie was inconsequential and drab. Now you're part of something larger, something greater. I am Charlie Etheridge Nunn, controller of the Amnesia Booth. You are not allowed to ask why an otherwise normal factory has an Amnesia Booth. You will be required to step inside the Amnesia Booth every Monday at 6:47 in the morning.
Hi, and I'm Miles Reed Lobato, a science fiction writer, and hi, I'm Miles Reed Lobato, a science fiction writer, and hi, I'm Miles Reed Lobato, and a science fiction writer, and I'm a fan of working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. Gotta lose your mind. I'm gonna in the Amnesia Booth. Hi. I'm Miles Reed Lobato, and a science fiction writer, and... Right, okay, I think I've got it. I think I've got the Amnesia Booth out of my head.
Very good. Yes, well, this is Casual Trek. You have been here forever. You enjoy this, don't you? I need no response from you, Miles. I know, I can see it.
I enjoy this.
Yes, yes.
You are magnificent. You do not smell of feet. And you have a full lustrous head of hair. You do not resemble Hercule Poirot in your everyday life.
I mean, I wish that facial hair, the Bran of Poirot.
Oh, the like, as much as I am like intermittently a fan of the Branagh Poirot films, Murder on the Orient Express, pretty fun. Haunting in Venice, really good. Death on the Nile, utter wank, but my god, his moustaches are magnificent.
They are, to the level where they get their own grimdark origin story.
Oh, I was watching that film in the cinema, and like the moment we got the grimdark World War I origin of Hercule Poirot's moustaches, I may have just like, right, okay, this film's lost me now.
And that's the difference between us, because that kind of thing just makes me cackle.
Oh, I cackled as well, but I'm just like, yep, okay, this film has now officially lost me, because that is hilarious.
Anyway, this is Casual Trek, where we, as fairly casual Star Trek fans, recap and rank episodes of Star Trek on a big list of best to worst, and we try not to be dicks about it. This episode, we're having a look at some memory-based workplace shenanigans. Yes, yes, this is a theme. But first, Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
I am actually going to have to mention a non-Star Trek thing I have not been enjoying.
Oh, no.
Because for some goddamn reason, I am reading Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged.
Oh, Miles.
I think I have issues. I think I hate myself.
Yeah. I mean, this feels like the ultimate expression of self-hatred.
Really. Like, I'll be honest, I'm only like 250 pages into this 1,048 page book, and it feels like I'm being lectured to by my mother-in-law about how the NHS is ontologically and unabashedly evil.
Wow. Yeah, you okay, just remember, you can give up on reading a book at any time.
I do, but I don't know. I think part of me is like, okay, know thy enemy. And the other part is, yeah, I feel like I've been kind of struggling creatively for a while, so I think I'm just kind of performing this kind of textural word enema on myself to filter out the bad things.
Wow.
Also, the book is reminding me why we don't talk to my mother-in-law at the moment.
Okay, good.
But oh dear God, the book is truly atrocious. And any person who says that modern science fiction, written by the woke libs, is basically characters being mouthpieces for the writer's political agenda, but they talk glowingly of Atlas Shrugged needs to shut the fuck up.
Well, yeah, that feels like someone who has not read Atlas Shrugged.
Because this book is the personification of Garth Marenghi. I know writers who use subtext and they're all cowards.
God, I still love the Atlas Shrugged trilogy of films. Had so many people drop out and so many funding issues that they had to go to crowdfunding. Something that Ayn Rand would absolutely hate and would go against her philosophies. So yeah, good. A deserving fate for it.
Yes. But on the plus side, it did make me start replaying Bioshock. A game where you can shoot bees out of your arms.
Hell yeah. I mean, who wouldn't want that?
People with tryptophobia.
I guess. Yeah, fine.
And Charlie, what non-Star Trek, and please for the love of God, what non-Ayn Rand thing have you been enjoying?
So, I'm a bit of a spreadsheet nerd. I have a pretty spreadsheet job. I have some giant spreadsheets of the varied comic reading lists that I've been doing. So, of course, when putting off doing more writing and more things, I've found another spreadsheety thing to do. And that's... So there's a website I often use for references for my reading lists, which is GCD, of Grand Comics Database. And I've been finding weird, obscure 2000 AD spin-offs or kind of, you know, sort of vague relations, story or title-wise. And there's so much missing data from 2000 AD. So what I've been doing in these last few weeks is going through from when my subscription started and kind of backfilling the data on the stories. And that's meant rereading a bunch of the issues, which any brand new weekly arrival comic wise tends to get a fairly quick read from me. So being able to actually sit a bit more with stories like Silver, with stories like Hearn and Shuck and The Discarded, and trying to get, you know, initially trying to get character names and details and things like that to log on here, but also just rereading them a bit has been kind of a nice exercise. I've got a sort of mentor slash proofreader with it, because it's like, GCD is very old internet looking, but it's, you know, it maintains a lot of data, so they do need to make sure that it's all checked and that. So yeah, most of, I don't know, the modern 2000 ADs, or at least the ones that have come out for the last few months, have been put up on there by me. And yeah, it's been kind of a very satisfying activity to do.
Charlie, You're a fastidious nerd.
Yeah, I know. I have so many better things that I could be doing, but it's still kind of nice to do. You know, there are some comic creators who I've got to add onto there because they've just not been on it yet. Anyway, moving swiftly on from my incredibly nerdy pursuit there, we are looking at a couple of episodes here. Our first one is Star Trek Deep Space Nine Season 4, Episode 19, titled Hard Time. Yes, this is yet another O'Brien Has a Bad Day episode. This aired on the 15th of April, 1996. Teleplay by Robert Hewitt Wolfe, story by Daniel Keyes Moran and Lynn Baker, and directed by Alexander Singer. UK number one hit was Mark Morrison with Return of the Mac, and the US had Celine Dion with Because You Loved Me, the theme from Up Close and Personal, a film I have no memory of. And yeah, what I do have a memory of is hearing that there were a lot of controversies in relation to Mark Morrison.
This is again one of those songs which is, oh, that's what the song is called.
Oh, what, with Return of the Mac?
Yes.
Yeah. That was, I mean, this would have been, start of sick form, possibly for me. So yeah, it was on radio quite a lot. And yeah, then a little bit afterwards, hearing an increasing amount of things about him where it's like, is this all right to listen to? which all seem fairly vanilla compared to modern musicians. So take your firearm on a plane, not appearing in court because he went to Barbados instead, getting in a brawl that led to a fatality, converting to Islam, driving without a license, kidnapping, car theft, probably bribed a policeman, failed to appear in court yet again, attempted to be mayor of Leicester, and it's been a life for him.
I feel like we need more pop stars to try and become mayors of British towns. Like I think we all want Taylor Swift to try and become mayor of Blackpool.
Yeah, she'd probably do an all right job.
Yeah.
As I've been listening to the No Gods, No Mayors podcast, and I'm increasingly aware of how unhinged mayors tend to be. More obscure 90s musicians as mayors, please.
Mm.
And yeah, the Celine Dion one was one I'd completely forgotten. Sadly, it's not one of her collaborations with Jim Steinman.
No.
So, Mars, you have 5 whole minutes to recap Hard Time. Otherwise, you'll be put in an imaginary cell where you'll have to recap it over 20 whole years.
I mean, having listened to you recap episodes, taking 20 whole years to do so, that feels like manageable.
I mean, that's harsh, but fair. Okay. Well, go.
In a lone cell, a shambling bearded figure. No, not the guy at the start of every episode of Monty Python's Flying Circus who goes, "It's..." sits, drawing geometric patterns in the sand. Wait a minute. It's Miles Edward O'Brien. I sense that only good things are going to happen from here on out. The door to the cell opens. The 20 years he has spent in prison for espionage is over, and he's free to go. And O'Brien wakes up. Wait, Kira's here. But it's been 20 years. Wait, no. On this planet, criminals have prison time implanted into their brains as fake memories as a way on saving on actual prisons. While O'Brien has lived a 20-year prison sentence, it's only been a few hours, but it feels all too real to one Miles Edward Tudor O'Brien. He's taken back to DS9, and O'Brien tries to readjust to his life after prison. Sisko tells Keiko, O'Brien's wife, that O'Brien was accidentally arrested for getting too curious about some technology on this planet, and by the time Starfleet was notified, the sentence had already been carried out. Turns out the memories can't be removed, but Bashir's going to try his best. O'Brien meets Bashir alone on the station, not wanting to be overwhelmed, while Bashir is going to run tests to see if the memories can be removed. O'Brien claims that he was alone in the cell the entire time, but we see flashbacks intermittently to his time in prison, and that he had a cellmate, this guy named Echarm, who was arrested for political sedition. Nope, O'Brien was totally alone. Nothing suspicious here. Bashir can't remove the memories. He tells Keiko that the process is so in-depth that, to him, O'Brien did live those 20 years, and he had made decisions that will affect him forever. But he's sure O'Brien will bounce back. After all, Miles Edward Tudor O'Brien's life is one of a lot of tragic things happening to, and he's been all right so far, right? Right? Adjusting proves difficult. O'Brien finds himself hoarding food, since that became habitual to him because the guards kind of forgot to feed and water the prisoners every so often. Stick a pin in that. But as we see in the flashbacks, it was Echarm who told O'Brien how to draw the geometric sand patterns as a way of relaxing his mind and body, because O'Brien does not take to relaxing very well. Echarm's ability to laugh also perplexes Miles Edward Tudor Blackadder O'Brien. How can he laugh in this situation? Well, says each arm, you either laugh or you go mad. Stick a pin in that. Keiko wakes up to find Miles sleeping on the floor just like he did in prison. While playing darts at Quark's with Worf, a dangerous pastime it seems, O'Brien sees Echarm wandering the promenade and follows him, but the figure disappears. This is fine. Returning to work, O'Brien is visited by Bashir, worried that he's not been attending his mandated therapy sessions with the station's counselor. But Bashir gets nothing but O'Brien snapping at him, telling him to stay away from him. In the flashbacks, O'Brien's time in prison is getting to him, and he nearly comes to blows with Echarm. On DS9, he attacks and threatens Quark for a simp fail. Echarm appears to him again. O'Brien tells him that he's not real, but Echarm replies that he's real enough to O'Brien. Again, this is fine. Nothing bad to be worried about. The visions of Echarm keep appearing to O'Brien, telling him that he's worried about his good friend Miles Edward Tudor Blackadder O'Brien, and that he just wants him to be well. Sisko is also worried about O'Brien's increasingly erratic behavior, wanting him to go back to therapy and removing him from duty. Sisko tells O'Brien that he needs help, no matter how O'Brien tries to convince him that he's fine. But if O'Brien doesn't cooperate, he's going to be confined to sickbay. O'Brien doesn't take this well, and he takes it out on Bashir, telling him that the Miles O'Brien, who was his friend, died in prison. The image of Echarm tells O'Brien that Bashir wants to help him and that he can't run from Echarm forever, and that's when O'Brien reveals to us that Echarm is dead. Returning to his quarters, O'Brien snaps at Molly, causing her to cry. O'Brien takes out his anger in the cargo hold and then breaks out a phaser from a weapons locker. Setting the phaser to full power, O'Brien puts it to his head, ready to pull the trigger.
Oh, we have 5 minutes. Also, one quick moment. I need to get a bee out of the room.
Okay. I was wondering why you were kind of looking around like a dog being shown a card trick.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's often my usual look, but no, right. Oh. Continue.
Bashir arrives and tries to talk O'Brien down, but O'Brien feels that removing himself would protect everyone else from the person he's become. O'Brien finally opens up to Bashir about Echarm, and we finally see the truth. 2 weeks or so before his release from prison, during a period when the guards were not giving them food, O'Brien discovered that Echarm was hoarding food, and in a rage, killed him, realizing too late that Echarm was actually saving food for both of them. Even worse, after O'Brien killed Echarm, the guards started feeding him again. He murdered his friend for nothing. Despite what Bashir says, O'Brien can't deal with the guilt of killing his friend, especially since mankind is believed to have evolved beyond such actions, and that now he sees himself as a failure of humanity and nothing more than an animal. Bashir tells O'Brien that his guilt is proof that O'Brien is still a good man and not the dangerous animal he believes himself to be. As O'Brien hands over the phaser, the ghost of Echarm tells his friend to be well and fades away. Bashir finally has a treatment for O'Brien to help with the depression and the hallucinations. The guilt and the trauma will take time, but finally, as he returns to his quarters and holds Molly tightly, Miles, Edward, Tudor, Blackadder Sean Cassidy O'Brien is finally home.
Ooh, yeah. So Emma and I watched this earlier today, and I was saying partway through, is this going to be another one of those ones, like how Neelix is traumatized by the non-existence of his afterlife and is just kind of, you know, working through it, or how Harry Kim apparently is killed and replaced with an alternate Harry Kim partway through Voyager and no one brings it up again. But O'Brien has had 20 years of trauma in prison in between season 4 episode 18 and season 4 episode 19, and from this point onwards this is something that O'Brien has had that is just gonna be there.
Thank God for the Star Trek reset button sometimes.
Yeah, God, you would be a wreck after that. I mean, I remember when people were going, oh, that episode of Buffy where it turns out, you know, where she's told that it's all fictional and that she's mad and all that. That should have been real. It's like, yeah, your show's over.
Yeah.
Basically, at that point, you are done. The same with any of those kind of things. But yeah, thanks to the weekly reset, you know, in a way, kind of, I guess, like the whole John Scalzi red shirts kind of thing of like, yeah, you've got these traumatic things. And then a week later, everyone seems back on their
feet. Fine. Yeah. I mean, I don't think we ever get sort of like an account of O'Brien going, yeah, I had to go to therapy or take it, or like having to take his the drugs that he needs to deal with his incredible guilt and depression that he now has.
Yeah, yeah, that's like it's another one of those episodes where, oh my God, yeah, they go through it. Like O'Brien has bad days, but yeah, this isn't like when I saw the pitch of this, I was like, okay, cool. We're going to get some weird, like, memory prison virtual thing and all that. But the fact that's ended at the end of a cold open, and instead we're seeing him reliving it and his PTSD, basically. So, oh, this is a bit more raw than I expected.
Like, this is what we wanted from Tuvix, let's be honest. That yeah. we wanted the entire episode where Neelix and Tuvok have to deal with the fact that they were an entire person for a couple of months.
I mean, I feel that one of those two is going to be more traumatized than the other.
Okay, so is this where we do have to do a content warning, because we're gonna talk about the fact that in a Star Trek you have a moment where a main character contemplates suicidal ideation.
True. Yes. Yeah. It's again, like, you hit O'Brien at his lowest at that point, where he knows that he can't be the O'Brien he used to be, where everything is in a bad state, and his hallucinated version of Ichar really doesn't help with this. You know, it's kind of, yeah, like a lot of it is that, like, the Ichar of the mind kind of haunting him, acting partly as that PTSD. And
I mean, like I kind of go to, like, Ichar, you know, Ichar is, honestly, like, unlike a lot of the hallucinations which you get in people's heads in science fiction, like, Ichar's like, he's a good one, because he turns up and goes, I think you need to go to therapy and talk to your friends about how you're feeling. Like, this isn't like a Farscape where he turns up in a Hawaiian shirt like Scorpius and goes, hey, everything's kind of bad.
If only. I was thinking with Ichar in the cell, especially with him being fairly jolly, about him being kind of like, well, at least he's not Stark. But yeah, I think you've got it right there with, yeah, that kind of, well, at least he's not not Harvey, the imaginary Scorpion.
I had a thought while watching this episode to the end.
Hmm.
Is Ichar and everything that happens to Ichar part of what is programmed into the prison sentence? Or is the prison sentence itself just kind of open-ended enough that O'Brien kind of fills in the blanks? Because if the prison experience comes with, oh, and by the way, we're going to make you think you're a murderer, that's just kind of evil.
It is. I think, I don't know, in my mind, when I was watching it, I was like, okay, the presence of Ichar is possibly a bit O'Brien filling in the blanks. You know, we were told this is kind of a prison optimized by your brain and kind of made bespoke to each person. I was surprised it wasn't just, oh yes, I'm on Deep Space Nine, only nothing will ever get fixed.
I am stuck for 20 years in a runabout with Bashir.
Mm.
And only Bashir.
I mean, that said, they're the likely lads. So
yeah,
that probably wouldn't be too bad for him.
It's that great line from Red Dwarf, where Holly says Jean-Paul Sartre, that, you know, that Jean-Paul Sartre once said that hell is being stuck in a room with your friends. And Lister replies, yeah, but all his mates were French.
Well, I think, I don't know, I'd be curious to know if there was any clarification on whether the death of Ichar was something that was being kind of nudged towards and encouraged by the program. Because, yeah, the people that did this, they are gone by the end of the first act.
Yeah.
Like, there is no talking to them, no, like, working through, hang on, what did your process do?
Like, or anything like that. So, apparently, at no point did they give Kira a pamphlet saying, right, so your friend's been in prison. So, here is what we made, this is what we did to him.
Well, yeah. Where,
I find it funny is that normally, you know, since usually in Star Trek, it's usually going to be he lives for 20 years and then he gets out end of episode, and we're going, but wait, we want to see the part where he recuperates. And now we've got the other end where it's just like, yeah, the weird shit happened was done by minute five. And we're like, yeah, but how does this work?
I mean, I don't mind not knowing how it works. Like, it would be interesting, but is not essential.
It's not essential, but I think it helps, because part of me was like, okay, is the hallucination also part of the programming?
Yeah.
As a way to rehabilitate, as a way to facilitate the recovery. But again, like you said, the aliens are gone. I guess they're gamma quadrant aliens as well, because they're flying through the wormhole.
Yeah, and their culture is one that's evidently unfamiliar and a bit weird compared to what they're used to around DS9. So yeah, it's interesting, and seeing that it was just a basic bit of nosiness about technology, which of course O'Brien would do. You know, he'd be curious about such things, and yeah, it all goes very wrong from there. And feels pointless, and that's kind of part of it, ultimately. Like, it is a pointless charge, but by the time the people come and get him, he's already been through these 20 years of imprisonment. Which, yeah, that's got to sting,
really.
I mean, from what I gather, the script writer of it, Robert Wolf, his wife Celeste was a family counselor and someone who actually acted as a consultant for it. So it's one of those times where you can go, oh no, they did actually speak to someone. Because sometimes, especially for a network science fiction TV show, you go like, oh, they did therapy really bad here, or trauma really bad.
You mean like Troy?
Yeah, you know, of going, I sense you're feeling distress. So I've got the phaser at my chin. yes, I do. God, that was one of those moments when he was doing that where I was thinking, what's the track record with this way of doing prison? Like, especially if it is a bespoke system for each person, you know, not necessarily a hell of your own making, but a prison of your own making. And if it can encourage things like Ichar's existence and death, all in a virtual space, like, are there any success stories from it?
I mean, that's the thing, is this, like, you know, does the society, because in theory, isn't a prison sentence meant to be like a process of social rehabilitation? But the thing is, you know, and also the same, it's not like, as far as I can tell, at least it's not like a for-profit based prison system, which, you know, no one would ever have run prisons for profit. That would be terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, weird that. Yeah. Well, in a way, it feels almost like the reverse of the Tech War prison, which I had a lot of problems with, because that was, you're put in a prison and you're put on ice for like 20 years. And now it's 20 years later and you've not had the time to rehabilitate. You are just suspended. And are you actually going to do anything? Do you go, oh, I've come out and I've thought about what I've done? No, you come out and go, oh, it's 20 years. I'm really annoyed with everything. And, you know, just, yeah. It's like, but, fucking.
Yeah. But I did like this. And, you know, honestly, it is, you know, down to Colm Meaney just knocking it out of the park.
He's so good. Yeah, he's really good. I really liked Muniz, his colleague, who is the first character in Star Trek to speak Spanish. And also another reminder that the engineers all seem quite nice.
Yeah.
You know, like when we saw them with Rom.
Rom.
A little while ago, where you go, oh, they're all a bit chummy. Like, you know, we don't get to see that with the engineers on the Enterprise or anything. Of like, yeah, you know, just a bit chatty.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you get the feeling that these guys like hang out and probably have a curry.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, a Phil O'Brien would probably insist, you know, a Guinness, a curry.
Yeah. There you go. I liked Bashir in this episode because they definitely dialed down, you know, they dialed down the Bashir is fundamentally annoying and play up the Bashir is actually a very good doctor and a good friend when the time calls for it.
Yes. Yeah, that was definitely like we're pre genetically engineered.
Yeah.
Bashir, but yeah, he is like, he catches some flack from O'Brien, but he is doing the things as both a doctor and a friend that you would expect as someone concerned for his bro.
See that's how you know that E-Sharp must in some way be real and not just a product of O'Brien's imagination, because every time Bashir is saying something, E-Sharp's like, yeah, this guy's actually speaking sense. Yeah. I think you need to listen to him. Because you know, if it's like purely a part of O'Brien's imagination, the E-Charm be just like, wanker.
God, I swear, there's a thing that I noticed over the years when I was watching a lot more prestige television, where even if the supernatural isn't a thing, you get your kind of prestige TV ghost. It would often pop up that would be the imagined version of someone, and it feels like this, like E-Char on DS9 is very much that kind of thing, like Rick's wife in Walking Dead, like so many kind of, you know, we're not saying this is a ghost, but kind of prestige thing of getting to have that, make the interiority external. And it definitely feels like a necessary thing here, because O'Brien goes through so much and is a character that locks it away generally. Like his immediate reaction to speaking to a counselor is like, yeah, no. Like he doesn't do that kind of thing.
You can tell this is written in the 90s.
Yeah. Before men were allowed to have something. Although even then, O'Brien feels like someone that would have internalized enough of that.
Yeah.
But he'd have issues with it.
My one real complaint is that I wish we had a bit more with Keiko.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Keiko doesn't really get, you know, every time we see Keiko doesn't get much to do beyond being, like, let's kind of be honest, the sitcom naggy housewife. Apart from when she's possessed by space ghosts.
Yeah.
So I guess it would have been nice to kind of send a bit more of Keiko. Maybe, you know, instead of like, and maybe you have the one scene where Sisko sits down O'Brien and goes, O'Brien, you have to go to therapy or we're putting you on suspension. Where you maybe have Keiko going, okay, you kind of need to be doing the therapy and the treatment.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think originally at the end, in one, I read somewhere that in one draft it was going to be Keiko who talks O'Brien down.
Yeah.
From unaliving himself. But instead they went with Bashir, which I think works. Also, Bashir's in the main cast, so...
Yeah, while it would have been nice for there to be something more for Keiko to do, it was fine. Yeah.
And I do like at the start, like, the implication I get in this show is that Kira and O'Brien just kind of vibe. Mm. Like, they're clearly not, like, best mates, like, say, Kira and Dax, or O'Brien and Bashir. But it's just like, yeah, these two get each other. They're good work they're good work friends.
Yeah, they've both done, you know, they're both of a type.
They've both killed Cardassians, and so therefore they are best friends for it. Oh my god. O'Brien,
they both like actual workers of the station rather than officers. But, you know.
Oh god. Imagine O'Brien hanging out with Shax.
I mean, that would
be amazing.
So I feel at that point, now we're hypothetically, you know, creating hangouts for these fictional characters. It's time for us to go to something of great import. Yes, it's our big list of best to worst. Our now 203 strong list, with the best Star Trek still being Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Our quarterest Star Trek being Star Trek TNG's Elementary Dear Data. Our halfway point being Voyager's Mortal Coil, and our three-quarter point being Voyager's Coda, and finally, at 203, we have Section 31. Oh my god, that was bad.
Yep.
So, where on our big list does Hard Time need to go?
I'm going to say I think it's a... I think it's pretty up there. Like it's got a good science fiction hook, which gives us some really good character drama, and yeah. And also O'Brien Must Suffer, which I feel either gets you good episodes of Star Trek or bad episodes of Star Trek, and this one gave us a really good episode of Star Trek.
True. Let's see. Okay, if we're looking at the drama, what do we have? So, I mean, there's the bonding, which has some drama and trauma with a, traumatized boy for all of the Enterprise adopt.
I think this is better than the bonding. Because I feel like, I don't know, I think at times the bonding is kind of let down by the child actor and just kind of the whole kind of ghost story aspect. Whereas yeah. I feel this is a much stronger character drama because what's happening is happening to one of the main characters. And so it allows you to give, allows the main character to, it allows for acting, dear boy.
Acting. Okay, good. I concur with that. I think above it we have Ties of Blood and Water, which again is like, that's Kira goes through it. Mm. Which is a bit more, on DS9, but has some nice emotional moments. I don't know, like, I feel out of the two, I might be thinking about this for longer than I'm thinking about Ties of Blood and Water.
Yeah. Because I would say, the moment when O'Brien gets the phaser and then just starts, I mean, that's the point where, like, okay, Star Trek very rarely goes here.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's not like, say, the Neelix episode where he thinks there's no afterlife and his reaction is, I'm just going to teleport myself into the goddamn nebula. Whereas here it's just like, yeah, O'Brien's wanting to kill himself.
Yeah. Yeah, God. Yeah, bit raw there. Okay. Like from that, we've got Devil in the Dark at 35 with, weird cave monsters, which is a tonal shift, I feel, from this.
Yep.
Yeah, still good, though.
It's a lot of fun. Okay. All right. Okay. At number 31, we have Arena, where Kirk fights the Gorn next to those rocks from Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
Oh, God. Actually, yeah, seeing that at 31 and Year of Hell at 30, I think this might be better than Arena, because as iconic as the Gorn and those rocks from Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey are, this has a lot of emotions.
Yes.
To it. I say that in my attempt at a David Cage impression. David Cage wishes he could do this. But at the same time, Year of Hell fucking rules.
Yep. Like,
I really enjoyed that. And as much as it is more of an action romp, I think I prefer that to this.
Yeah. And I think Year of Hell gives the ensemble a bit more of a chance to play. Like, hey, you get Chakotay gets to do stuff. And Tom Paris gets to Tom Paris.
Hey, Engineer Neelix.
Like Engineer Neelix. Harry Kim still not getting promoted.
Well, no. And the dad from that 70s show. Cool. So that puts this at number 31.
All right. I'm good with this.
Our second episode is actually a two-parter. It's Star Trek Voyager, Season 7, Episodes 16 and 17, titled Workforce, Parts 1 and 2. It aired on the 21st and 28th of February 2001. Part 1 was written by Kenneth Miller and Brian Fuller, directed by Alan Croker, and Part 2's teleplay was Kenneth Miller and Michael Taylor, story by Kenneth Miller and Brian Fuller, and directed by Roxanne Dawson. Yes, B'Elanna Torres herself. The UK number one hit was Atomic Kitten with Hole Again, and US with Joe Feet Mr. Cow, not spelt the way you think it would be, and Stutter. Stutter wasn't great.
No.
No, although it did get me re-listening to Farside, who they sampled, didn't pay or credit, and then got in a court case.
Oh, lovely.
Out. Yeah, yeah. So,
Okay, I'm just going to say this up front. It is weird to have an episode of Star Trek where Brian Fuller is in the creative process for Voyager, and there isn't no saying, in an earlier draft, one of the main cast tried to eat their own leg.
Yeah, yeah, nothing, no Hannibal bullshit.
No. At no point did I read the note, Harry, where it's like Harry Kim has stomach worms, and at no point do we hear, say, and then there was an internet discarded draft that the worms won and devoured Harry Kim whole.
Yeah, yeah. We got to see the worms coming out of his mouth and eyes. And no, Brian. Well, okay. Phoning it in at this point? Was he, I don't know, maybe he was doing Dead Like Me and getting all of his Brian Fullerness out on that by this point.
So, okay, Brian, good job. You can have a cookie.
Yeah. Oh. So, this is a two-parter, and I'm going to try and recap the whole thing in one go. We'll see if it works.
Okay, so 10 minutes, right?
Yep.
All right, so I've set a timer for 20. Okay, I haven't. I've set a timer for 10.
okay, fine. I can sense your optimism in my ability to do that.
I mean, Charlie, we are closer to 100 than we were 82 episodes ago. And so I have had 81 episodes of past performance.
Fine.
It's Charlie, don't get angry at me. Get angry at the scientific method.
Get angry at the system.
Well, that's a given.
Yeah.
I was speaking to my mum earlier today on the phone, and she was a bit upset at my point of view that we should abolish the monarchy. Yeah, I know. I mean, I know. What I must be. I think I'm adopted.
Wow.
God. All right. At least I didn't say what I normally say to people when they ask me about the royal family, which is fuck them.
Which, yeah, right. Fuck them. Right. I think that's fuck the em. Official stance of Casual Trek.
Yeah. Although she was also going on about how the Green Party have gone crazy. I'm just like, okay, you need to stop reading those newspapers, Mum.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not healthy.
No. Anyway, do you know what is healthy?
What?
Charlie trying to recap a two-part episode of Star Trek in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And go.
Right, I'll clock in for my shift. We're on a factory planet and see a familiar face among the aliens and the ropey CGI. It's Janeway. It's her first day at work at a power plant and she's a bit late. She's excited to be here because she's a big old nerd. The camera gets ambitious, panning all around her, and she puts in an error, only to get corrected and flirted with by Jaffin, another worker. The fun police shows up, and it's Annika Hansen, aka 7 of 9, who, of course, is an efficiency officer at this factory. She doesn't seem to know Janeway, though. Jaffin invites Janeway to dinner, and she turns him down. Speaking of being turned down, Tom Paris washed out at the power plant after half a day. Amazing. His story is charming and a bit pathetic, and enough to have the bar's landlady hire him as a bartender. Later, the bar gets packed, and Tuvok's there laughing. Okay. And over-explaining a joke someone makes to a painful level that only a Vulcan would do. Jaffin spots Janeway revising and hangs with her. She says that Earth was overcrowded, polluted, and violent with no work. So she ended up here. Odd. Yeah. They're stopped as they walk home, as there's apparently a curfew, but their company housing is near, and they're both really stoked about that. He wants to invite her back for coffee, but and no, date over. Back to the factory! There's an alarm! It's inoculation time for everyone! Tuvok's scared of injections, and as a flashback, we see him in his Starfleet uniform, getting restrained and injected with something. The time for flashbacks is over. Now it's back to work. Now, we're following a Starfleet shuttle on its way back to Voyager. Kim, Chakotay, and Neelix have been on Nar Shaddaa, I guess probably a different one from the Star Wars one. Harry's drunk some kind of bad meat nectar and has a dicky tummy from it. And Voyager isn't where it's supposed to be. Instead, it's drifting in the middle of nowhere with the Doctor trying to fix things. It's got a cool red bar on his uniform, and Voyager's got no power. There's intruders on the bridge, and of course it's Chakotay and Harry checking everything out. The Doctor says 12 hours after they left, the ship hit a subspace mine, and then we get a flashback. Everyone was getting sick from radiation, and the Doctor was changed to the Emergency Command hologram, while all the life forms left on escape pods so he could fix it all in their absence. Unfortunately, they got abducted, he got fired on, and he had to flee. Tuvok starts spying on Janeway in the factory and has a flashback to being shoved around with her in a kind of zombie fugue state. Dr. Caden says he'll help, injects and treats her, which is what led to Tuvok being restrained in that other flashback a moment ago. In the present, Tuvok's really sweaty and confronts Janeway, saying he knows her from hospital. She's like, I've never been in hospital before. And Jaffin splits him up. He asks Janeway to join him for a meal, and this time she's going for it. Good for her. At the bar, Torres is there. She's reading up on something when Tom notices he fails his flirt role multiple times, and then she stands up to show that she's pregnant. She is still single, though. So, game on. On Voyager, they've restored things and are looking for their people. The ECH reports to Chakotay, who orders him around, and the Doc gets all pissy about it. Harry's found the crew 3 days away, and Chakotay relinquishes the captain's chair to the Doctor, quite nicely. At the factory block, Janeway cooks for Jaffin, and it is rubbish. She suggests they go out for dinner, and he says he doesn't want to eat food, and they stay in. Voyagers found the planet Quora, and the Quarrans, again, not Star Wars Quarrans, different Quarrans. These guys are really surly. They say that, yes, your crew are here, but they've found work, and they don't remember Voyager anyway. Maybe go somewhere else. Stop asking us questions, when they should have just said no. At the bar, Paris sees Torres again and offers to be a friend rather than a boyfriend, and introduce her to a couple who are expecting a kid that is met. Neelix has been speaking to local spaceships near Quora, and there's a massive labour shortage. He and Chakotay are going to go down to the planet pretending to be workers who are in need of employment. Chakotay was seen by Quarran authorities, so he gets a makeover before going down to the planet in Neelix's real trash-looking spaceship. Harry's going to be big dog on Voyager, but the Doctor doesn't like that, and they're going to sort it out for themselves because Chakotay doesn't give a shit about their drama. Annika's noticed that Tuvok's not been reporting for his jabs, and he sweatily mind melds with her before being dragged away. We get Chakotay's first day on the job. He introduces himself to Janeway, who doesn't recognize him at all. And similarly, Neelix talks with Paris, who doesn't recognize him. Doesn't even know what is a starship anyway. Neelix and Chakotay compare notes and then chat with Janeway and Jaffin briefly, but he quickly moves Janeway away as he wants to ask her to move in with him. She says yes. Chakotay and Neelix jump Torres on her way back from the bar, and Neelix beams up with her while Chakotay's on the run, so they couldn't beam him up in time. To be continued right now. Chakotay gets a pipe and lays into things and then double hand punches a guy. Voyager's getting shot at by Quarrans and has to retreat. Chakotay heads back to the bar, and Janeway apologizes for Jaffin's rudeness, not noticing his wounded shoulder. She does mention her moving in news. Put a pin in that. Alien David Spade is out hunting for Chakotay. He's from Criminal Investigations and asks Tom about new arrivals. Tom then points at the cartoon cloud of smoke where Chakotay was just a second ago. Voyager hides in a moon's crater quite nicely, with the Doctor examining Torres's brain. Specific bits have been messed with and need unpicking. Speaking of which, at the brain lab, a Dr. Ravok is asking Caden a lot of questions about what's up with Tuvok. He's having some kind of dysphoric episode. Apparently Tuvok said someone pinched his catra, and we don't know what that is. Tuvok asks for help, and they say, yeah, we're helping, and then set about brainwashing him. We next see the factory, but it's green. Oh no, that's a Borg ship. Annika's having flashbacks as well now. She asks about Tuvok. David Spade shows up asking about Neelix, Torres, and Chakotay. Janeway is unpacking her things. Apparently a few weeks here, and she's a hoarder already. She heads back to her old apartment, and Chakotay's decided to squat in there. He's all wounded and talks with her about needing a place to stay for a bit. Neelix starts giving B'Elanna Torres the guide, the tour around Voyager. Look, here's a photo of her and Tom. Here's his old TV, her bat'leth, a baby's crib with Hallmark Star Trek Christmas decorations dangling over it. Janeway pinches some first aid tech from her locker, and you can tell something's up with Annika because she lets this slide. She's on her way to check out Tuvok's files and sees he arrived there at the exact same time as 100 other individuals, including her. Janeway fixes up Chakotay and asks if she ever wanted anything more challenging in life, maybe running a spaceship. He gets a call from Voyager, who found a way to break through the planet's shield for a chat. They'll be there in a couple of days, and Janeway's shaken when she's referred to as a captain. Chakotay fixes his face as well to show he's human too. Yeah, now you believe me, right? Jaffin freaks out at all this news and squeals for filth. Chakotay's immediately shot, and alien David Spade tries interrogating him, but the other authorities arrive from Division 6 and take Chakotay away. David Spade's suspicious about this. On Voyager, Neelix makes pancakes for Torres, her favourite. She's also reading Tom's personal logs, which is a bit of a breach there, but fine. Harry is still getting pissy with the Doctor, and Chakotay gives them an obviously under duress message, giving them coordinates for a trap. Ravok is asking more questions of Kaden, and he's not happy about this. Is this weird outbreak of dysphoria something from the power plant? Kaden gives him a bit of a mocking. Annika and David Spade talk about the surprise arrival of 100 people in the middle of a labour shortage and how shady Division 6 are. David Spade says, yeah, but I've been relieved from this investigation now. He pops up at Jaffin and Janeway's place, even despite that. Has he met Chakotay? No. Well, yes. Jaffin tries to take the blame for the whole Chakotay incident, and Janeway won't let that slide and tells the truth. Annika heads to Division 6, saying about having troubled feelings.
Oh.
Oh. Well, well, well.
Well, okay. Well. You know how you said that Jaffin invites Janeway back to his place, but he's not hungry. You know that in the Brian Fuller in the original first Brian Fuller draft, he then tries to eat a guy.
Oh, okay.
I'm not hungry for food. Oh, just takes a big bite out of his fucking arm.
Wow, that's impressive work. That's dedication.
Mm. You
know. God.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I've got the stopwatch going and continue.
Yeah, so, yes. Anyway, yeah, apparently Annika gets left alone and rifles through all their files. And apparently every arrival out of those 100-odd had dysphoria problems and then got sent to the factory. Ravok notices all of this and he accuses Kaden. And look, kid, everyone knows about this. We need workers, and Kaden, he's got to get his slice of the action. The Fuzz pop up at the bar, and Tom gets evasive with them. And when they leave, all of our cast pop up. Annika says many more workers than Voyager's crew have been affected like this, possibly even Jaffin. Janeway mentions how Voyager got in touch with her. David Spade takes Annika into Division 6, saying he's caught her, but it's a fake out. He pulls a gun on Kaden. Janeway calls Voyager, and even with amnesia, she tells Harry to fucking get in his lane. She's going to cut the power, meaning shields will fail and the crew can be beamed out. While she's doing this, there's a shootout in the factory, and Jaffin comes along to help. Oh, he does love her. Voyager still falls into the trap despite all of this, and Kim and the Doctor have a bit of a panic, and Harry launches the escape pods, knowing the quarantine ships will prioritize capturing more workers, but they're not filled with crew, they're filled with explosives. Yeah. Janeway reaches her goal, makes the computer think there's been an overload, and it shuts the power down. And yeah, so David Spade and Annika rescue Ravok, Chakotay, and Tuvok from the brainwashing machines. The shields drop. Voyager's crew are all beamed out and to safety. Yeah! After all this, everyone's back and being treated. The government guy, who's played by Jennifer Aniston's dad, is shocked about this. Shocked, I tell you. They're going to check everyone for brainwashing and then repair them. Tom is back in his quarters watching cartoons. Torres kisses him for looking out for her even with amnesia and gives him a little punch on the arm for flirting with his customers. Janeway sees Jaffin, who apparently wasn't a brainwashing victim, just came from a shit world needing work. Rather than joining her as a platonic engineer, he's going to be manager of the factory now. Janeway, she's back on the bridge, bitches. She's had a nice time down there, but it's no Voyager.
2 minutes and 53 seconds.
Okay, I mean, for a two-parter, that's yeah. All right. That's all
it
right.
It was kind of refreshing to see a Star Trek two-parter where it's not all like universe-shattering implications and drama. It was just like, yeah, here is an episode which it's going to be two parts of length, because, you know, we can't fit it all into one. It's just a brand new exciting adventure for the Voyager gang.
Yeah, it was really nice having, you know, stakes that aren't galaxy destroying, but are, you know, this was a big thing. It was, you know, like, not even as dramatic as Year of Hell, but there were a lot of problems and fixing it took a lot of work. Yeah, like, Roxanne Dawson, I know she's done other Star Treks after this. I think this is maybe her second credit of directing. Because, yeah, Rick Berman said he was going to give her another opportunity to fail by doing this, which she took as in a positive way, or decided to look at it in a positive light. And yeah, since then, she's done some very good directing, including of episodes of Lost. But yeah, you can see, like, Alan Croker did some all right stuff with episode one, but episode two has a bit more of a directed feel almost. But yeah, like, this had some nice challenges, and if you are abducting the entire crew, then you get some fun with the Doctor up on the ship, and you do kind of have to check in with everyone. So yeah, it was nice seeing Janeway having a nice romance.
It was nice to see Catherine Janeway actually happy and responsibility free.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, when the guy popped up, it's like, you've only got, what, another six or so episodes in the show. You could have just have this guy here. Mm. Like, you know, when she was like, you could be an engineer, obviously there'd be no workplace fraternization. It's like, just come on board as the captain's consort, fuck it.
Yeah.
But no, like, no.
Did I mention we are a moneyless society?
Exactly. There's no issues of, you know, I need money. We can generate food. Look, we can generate power. We've got a holodeck.
Look, we've had enough crew member get killed over the last 7 years that we can justify having you on board.
Yeah, like, we've probably got a bunch of ship's quarters that are completely empty. You know, like,
you know, the guy playing the Star Trek Voyager game remembered to build quarters this time, so his crew are happy.
Oh, my third playthrough is going so badly.
Oh no.
So many people are dead. So many, so many, like, lead characters are dead now.
Good job.
They've got quarters though.
I love the fact that Harry seems to now be self-aware of the fact that he is the character in this show who is going to suffer.
Yeah, yeah. He doesn't quite get to the level of O'Brien, or at least in what I've seen so far. Obviously, I've seen for seasons 5 through 7, and maybe, like, is the finale and the episodes we've covered here. So he might become the O'Brien. But, man, he's a whiny little piss baby here.
Yep.
Like, I get that the Doctor got no respect in season one, but he's the emergency command hologram. Even Chakotay goes, yeah, fuck it, you've got the chair. I want to do other stuff. You know, I'm second in command. I'm not for the chair. I'm for away missions. I know what Riker's life was like. I'm like dull Riker. And yeah, but no, Harry being like, well, I may be an ensign, but I'm human. So yeah, fuck. Like, anything could pull rank on you. So yeah,
Man, if only the emergency command hologram had slapped Harry in the face, like, backhand smash. It's great to see the Doctor just, you know, the emergency command hologram is fun. I did appreciate how at the second half they illustrate the emergency command hologram's flaws without kind of spelling out for the audience, is that, yes, he has all this tactical information, like all these tactical subroutines in his brain, but he doesn't have that initiative or instinct that Harry has, because it's Harry who comes up with the idea of putting bombs in the escape pods.
Yeah, and while it's nice that he did that, it's good that it wasn't like, checkmate hologram kind of thing, or like, you may have all the tactical knowledge, but I've got the heart. Anything like that. It's like, no. We're above this. It's fine. It would have been fun if there was like a little thing of like, this is the command hologram. This one has some hair.
Oh, a swagger stick.
Yes. A beard, maybe. Like a refined beard. And like, well, obviously. Like, I think the guy from Picard has like minor changes in the very different holograms that he's got.
Oh, the Rios holograms.
Yeah, Rios, that's it.
Yeah.
But yeah, one day we are going to have to return Picard.
That's true.
Yeah.
Like, other bits I did like, I do agree with B'Elanna. Tom Paris should not be, as someone who is on a lot of customer service, no flirting with your customers, Tom.
No.
Even if it does turn out they're actually your wife and the mother of your unborn child, you've just all had your memories erased.
Yeah. I think both the romance with Jaffin and the kind of the friendship, the friendmance of Tom and B'Elanna were dealt with in quite nice human ways. And I know when Brian Fuller left the Star Trek Empire, part of it was he was getting frustrated about fights, about having not being able to humanize characters as much as he'd like. But this felt like there was a lot of humanity in them.
I wish we got a bit more of emotional Tuvok. Because Tuvok kind of disappears in the second episode, but we know it. But it's also the moment you see Tuvok laughing in the bar, you're like, okay, something is wrong here.
Yeah, I did like that sense of that kind of jarringness of like, oh no, oh, something's awry. Although, yeah, he did look very sweaty, and there were a couple of shots where the ear prosthetic was a little too visible.
Ooh, I did not notice that.
I saw. I was too busy looking at, just sweat.
The sweaty head.
I think it didn't help that I got paused. I paused it at one point because I had that thing that I never expected to have in the modern day. I got called on by Jehovah's Witnesses.
Wow.
I know. I had to quickly pause, run out, and they were like, hello, we're Jehovah's Witnesses. I was like, oh. And I said, they looked at me. I think I was wearing my Windows 95 t-shirt. Looked around and were like, I'm just realizing we're probably not speaking to the right person here. I was like, nope, God, no. And slammed the door. So yeah, it was good fun.
Nice, good. I'm so happy for you. This was a really fun two-part story. Although there were times when I did have to shout out, it's a metaphor for capitalism.
It is very much a metaphor for space capitalism, definitely. That sense of, like, again, it was interesting seeing a factory world, an overworked world, a world where, frankly, if not for all the brainwashing, you probably would have had workers who were fine working there, even if it was for a bit. But
okay, I'm just going to say this. If this were a 70s Tom Baker Doctor Who, this would have actually been filmed at a nuclear power plant in Swansea.
Yeah.
And it would have looked great because it had been shot. It's location filming, so it would have been shot on film. But I'm like, yeah, we're just going to have the cast and crew just walk around a nuclear power plant, and it's fine.
Yeah. It's like, once we were in the set, it looked like a good set. There was some obviously repurposed bits. There was like a special effect that felt like a different colored version of Seven of Nine's charging booth. Like, apparently the Quarren ships were just repainted Breen ships. Like, while, like, Star Trek series, when they get to this point where we're nearing the end of the show, it feels well made, but also still cheap as hell.
Yeah.
Star Trek has always been about cutting them corners.
It is, you know, it's, you're seeing Star Trek start to embrace like more CGI. And there are times when you had the location shots of like the factory and you got people walking in the distance. I'm like, man, this looks just like the trip they were doing on Babylon 5.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah, there are some real ropey bits of it here. But yeah, as a whole, I found this was a fun quandary. Like, it was an issue that you don't often see these kind of worlds. Like, the big capitalist extractive societies are people like the Ferengi, where a lot of it's more about wheeler-dealer kind of stuff. Same with Talaxians.
Yeah.
But with this, where it is, yeah, we need this constant...
Like,
why do they have this labor shortage? What has caused this? Is it because the work is terrible? Is it because it's a shit place to be ultimately? But
do you know what would have been a very interesting but different way to have done this, but which I don't think would work in your typical Star Trek format? If the entire story had been from the point of view of the police guy and the medical guy, because I really liked how in the second part, when the police officer became a bit more prominent to the story, it kind of became this like 70s conspiracy thriller.
Oh god. Yeah.
And I'm like, what if it had been like you start off with this police guy on this planet and then he comes across Tuvok and then we start to uncover what the fuck is, and we see the Voyager crew and we're just like, oh god, what's going on here? And then we slowly peel back the layers of what the story.
Yeah, that would have been pretty cool. Like, Robert Joy, I think, was it Robert Joy? Yeah, the investigator guy, he was good fun. Like, I kept calling him David Spade, because he did have a bit of a weird alien David Spade vibe to him. But he was my namesake in Land of the Dead, so I was sure I recognized him from somewhere. Which was kind of cool to see. But he was really good. Yeah, the younger doctor, Ravok, and his disillusionment, like showing, oh no, this isn't a cultural thing. This is a conspiracy that is happening, that Caden, Ralph Mouth from Happy Days is doing. And that he and like the supervisor of the factory that, like, they go, yeah, we're short of workers. Let's just abduct some people.
Charlie, you know, no space body wants the space work no more.
Well,
I mean, yeah. I've heard that a few times in the last few years. I just wanted to say, has anyone ever really wanted to work?
Man, like, you look at the way in which people are governing things or CEOs, companies, and yeah, no one wants to work anymore. This is why your people with your email jobs, your kind of manager class are trying to do AI for everything, because they don't want to work. And, you know, that's fine. None of us do. But could they not be so very, very shit about it?
Yeah. Yeah.
But no...
as always, love a Star Trek story which starts in medias res, because like, I love the fact that it starts after they've been abducted and we're just seeing them in this world and then letting the story breed a sense of unease from the word go, when it's just like, oh, here's Janeway, Janeway smiling. Janeway's getting her flirt on. Yeah.
Yeah, I knew there were, like, memory issues, like amnesia stuff. But, watching the cold open, it's like, well, yeah, is this that she's infiltrating here and gets caught? Is it, like, what is the thing here? And then you gradually unpack, like, oh, and Seven of Nine's here. They don't appear to be acknowledging each other. And Tom Paris, who again, like, we see enough information to go, we know this is Tom. But, oh God, and I love that they were all brainwashed and taken to a factory and he couldn't even cut it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, Tom's attitude was so bad that he was thrown out of a labour shortage place where they brainwash people into being compliant workers.
And then we see Tuvok life and like, right, something is off.
Yes. Yeah, it's really well handled, all of this. So yeah, I very much enjoyed it. It's not, you know, a revolutionary episode, but
no. Again, this is for me, this is one of those Star Trek episodes which fits into the category of this is a good mid-tier Doctor Who, where we have a bunch of characters running up and down like three corridor sets, hiding from bad guys.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, on the whole, like it was a good fun story. I feel some characters some of the main of the characters kind of get a bit underserved by the plot, like Tuvok and Torres. Although there is something weird about Chakotay and Neelix going on this covert mission, and their first action is, yeah, let's kidnap the pregnant lady.
I mean, I feel that was a lot more a crime of opportunity. It felt very much like a role playing group thing. Of like, look, we're in a bar, we're seeing one of our crew who is an amnesiac wandering off alone, let's just abduct her.
Yeah,
you know.
And oh, okay, again, one last Doctor Who comparison,
right?
End of episode one cliffhanger, Chakotay's trapped, there's no escape. Beginning of episode two, Chakotay's free in 30 seconds.
Yeah, he has escaped.
Usually, a lot of Star Trek cliffhangers are usually like the big revelation or the big space opera moment. Whereas a lot of Doctor Who cliffhangers is the Doctor or the companion are trapped. Oh wait, no, they're not. It is quite literally the Rihanna and I just recently rewatched Misery. It is he didn't get out of the cock-a-doodle car cliffhanger resolution.
Yeah, it felt very much like moments I've had playing Hitman, where I've accidentally alerted absolutely everyone and somehow managed to run, hide somewhere, knock someone out, change clothing, sit on a bench, just be like, fuck. Oh my God. Like, I'm fine. I've escaped, but I just need a minute.
Mm.
And yeah, Chakotay's like that, just a bit of a bloody shoulder while he does it.
I think Chakotay secretly doesn't want to be a revolutionary terrorist. He just wants to be James Bond. Because anytime Chakotay seems to get a chance to do a spy mission, Chakotay's like, right, everything's coming up, Chakotay.
It's so often when he's on the ship, he feels like he is more of a rules follower than Janeway is. And yet, when he's off the ship, I think you're quite right there. Of like, yeah, action Chakotay. I'm not great at this. So no, son.
Look, you're better at this than Tom Paris would have been, because Chakotay is book James Bond, racism and all. Whereas Tom Paris would try to be film James Bond and just immediately punch someone in the face.
Okay.
Meanwhile, Neelix would basically be John Steed from the Avengers, complete with bowler hat.
I mean, that said, that is something I would want to see.
I would love to see Neelix dressed in a three piece suit with a brolly and a bowler hat. I think Neelix would find that neat.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. But now we're talking about Neelix's sartorial choices, so we should put this on the big list.
We should. Now, this is a tricksy one. I feel it's not really as, like, while we had a lot of fun, this isn't a year of hell.
This is definitely in our mid-range, where it's good Trek, it's not fantastic science fiction, it's not terrible science fiction, but it is good mid-range Trek.
Yeah. Let's see. Okay.
So let's have a okay. So all right. I'm looking at 104, which is Prodigy's mid-season one finale, 9 and 10, A Moral Star, where the team also have to go on a mission to break a bunch of people out of a unwanted situation. And whereas that Prodigy, they're very much doing a Starfleet. Yeah. This one, I don't, less so, but I feel they're both in a very similar vein.
Yeah, they're strangely comparable. I feel, as you say, Prodigy does a bit more of doing a Starfleet. You got a lot more kind of core plot stuff going on.
You have a lot of pieces coming together. Whereas yeah. I feel this is much more a, hey, we're just having an adventure with the gang.
Yeah, I feel Moral Star probably pips it just a bit. Let's see. Okay, we got Stars at Night. Again, we're talking quite almost plot critical kind of episode with the season 3 finale for Lower Decks, where Shax actually gets to do what Shax has always wanted to do.
Below that at 106, we have your boy Garf of Izar, with Whom Gods Destroy.
Love him. Okay. I think, God, both muck around with prisoners and things. I think this is
better, although it doesn't have the insanity of Whom Gods Destroy, because no one explodes.
Yes. But yeah, which is always marking a thing down. Just if we don't say it, then just imagine us like thinking no one exploded in this episode.
Yeah.
Therefore it's a rank or two lower than it probably should be.
Like we have the exploding list, which is basically the episode of Deep Space Nine when Odo fucking explodes, and then everything else is ranked at the bottom of the list because it doesn't have Odo exploding.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is Whom Gods Destroy in between those.
Has Yvonne Craig, you know, it is basically the Pucci principle of people exploding, which is, has someone exploded? No. Can we just stand around saying, why hasn't anyone exploded yet?
Exactly. So yeah, even though this isn't as wacky as Whom Gods Destroy, yeah, I think this is a better story overall.
Yeah.
So yeah, that put this at the new 106. Nice. So that's our episode.
Our shift is finished. So well, I guess we need to go, our shift is finished. I guess we need to go to the amnesia booth.
Yes, we will clock out and record episode 82 again in a few minutes.
Right, awesome. Yeah. I love that for us.
I love our mandatory work.
Yeah. Because if no one is going to talk about how to put Star Trek on a big list, then no one will do it.
Yeah. Okay. So that's it for us for this week. Miles, you're up decision-wise for next time. What are we doing?
Well, we are actually going to be doing we're going to do a second episode about everyone's big-eared, weirdly lobed, thinly veiled anti-Semitic stereotype, the Ferengi.
Hooray! Yeah, so more space capitalism.
More space capitalism.
Okay, good. Yeah, you can, of course, find us on Ko-fi as Casual Trek, on Facebook and Blue Sky also as Casual Trek. And Miles, where can folks find you?
Well, they can find me at my Blue Sky account at milesreedlabato.bsky.social, or you can find me at my blog at mareedlabato.wordpress.com, where I recently put out the second chapter of my account of my January hospitalization and discovering I have heart issues.
Yeah, it's been interesting seeing, yeah, kind of rather than fiction or reviews from you, going into something a little more personal.
Yeah. And Charlie, where can the folks find you?
So I am on Blue Sky at skyshark.itch.io. I post about X-Men fairly regularly there. I'm also on fatetales.com, where any kind of blog posts or anything I do are, and hopefully by the time this goes up, I will have my 1986 retrospective of 2000 AD. Because, I want to get reading 1987, as I've been in a very 2000 AD mood. And yes, go do a Starfleet and report and the amnesia booth.
And eat a eat a jelly baby and support your local union rep.
Damn straight.
Which I suppose on this podcast would be you.
Oh God.
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, yeah, you're the union. You're our union rep.
Oh my God. We're doomed.
Yep. All right. Bye all.
Bye.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and High podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Lobato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Star Trek by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.